Thank you, Judy. Sharon Crane, alcoholic. Hi, thanks. It's great to be here, and thank you so much, Barry, for picking me up and had a delightful afternoon and dinner with you and got to know you more. And that's the how my AA life and my life gets bigger. I go to a lot of meetings, and we have a lot of fun. So if you're not laughing, you're missing the biggest joke there is, which is yourself. So you gotta kind of, you know, have some humor with all of this, because, I mean, each one of us have had, we didn't wake up in, in George Clooney's home over there in Italy and on Lake Cuomo and go, oh, my God, I think I'll join AA today. My life is great. You know, it's, I think you kind of got thrown in here or crawled in here or had a little bit of pain to put yourself in the seat. So I think there were 25 newcomers. I'm so delighted that you're here and you're going, yeah, right. If you're not happy to be here, that's a good thing too. But keep coming, because we're the lucky ones. Not everybody gets to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody gets a chance to hear the truth of Chapter 5, you know, hear the hope of Chapter 5. Not everybody gets that chance. And, you know, my job is just to basically take a little stone and throw it in the pond, and wherever the ripples land, they land. And but my job as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is to go out in the world and try to be a good example, whether you're watching or not. So if you're new, this is a way of life. It's, and if you're old and you're bored, get going, because, you know, you're probably boring. There's probably a lot to do around here. But I've been sober 31 years, 11 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days. And, yeah, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just must tell you, my mother sleeps at night because I'm in your midst. And for that, I'm overpaid. And, okay, if you're new, just come back for a second. Make your feet your friend. Don't listen to your head. You know, if we sat at the coffee shop tonight and listened to all the good ideas that every newcomer has in this room, it'd probably be the greatest story ever told, but, you know, the book of short stories and short ideas. But your head is out to get you. Your feet will be your friend. And I want to see those toes manicured and looking pretty, because your feet get you to meetings. Your feet act your way into some sort of good living. I mean, I love my feet. I take care of my feet, because my head still, sometimes it's just fed, watered, and rested and waiting for me to wake up in the morning. You know, it's just got some bright ideas for today. And alcoholism centers in my mind, and I just don't listen to that vulture so much anymore. And I guess it's like gremlins. You know, you don't feed them after midnight or they just multiply. And so I don't take it out very much and play with those ideas I have. I'm very much in my seat in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really glad that I'm with a bunch of activists, because we have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun. We cry through the sad times, and we cry through the happy times, and we laugh at the sad times, and we laugh at the happy times. And you're my people. I was a little girl growing up in Iowa, and yes, which was my first resentment, I must say. But I waited for the mothership, because I knew that the chute opened a little too soon before I got to California. And it must have malfunctioned in a cornfield somewhere, and there I was. And I am the only alcoholic in my family. I was always a little too wiggly, a little too restless. I cried when I left, always old people. Didn't matter whose old people they were. We could have been an elevator operator. My mother said I always cried when I saw old people because I knew they were going to die. And I was just a little more energetic than everybody else in my family. So I don't know. There's nobody falling out of the family tree alcoholic, but I have it. I've got three other siblings, and parents were an alcoholic, and everybody seems to be fine. And then there's me. And I stood out. I had a lot of talent as a young girl. I had a lot of aspirations. I had a lot of hopes and dreams. And I started drinking alcohol on a country road under a full moon in the middle of the summer I was turning 13, and sitting on the hood of that 57 Chevy, the Clark boys. And they let me hang out with them that night, and they started passing around Canadian Club and Schlitz beer, and pretty soon I wasn't so knock-kneed anymore. Pretty soon my little legs were filling out. Pretty soon my trainer bra woke up. Pretty soon, you know, those football players were looking like someone I could go up and stand right next to. And pretty soon Jeanette Andrews with her 38 Ds didn't bother me anymore. And, you know, I was a center of attention that night. I drove cars. I won the chug-a-lug contest right out of the gates. And I don't remember getting home, and I felt really lousy the next day going to church with my family, but there was something that clicked big time in me. There were the spirits of alcohol filled that spiritual hole for me. I've always been a seeker, a little girl looking for something. I mean, I really always was. I wanted to be a nun. I thought that was a calling, you know. I found some notes recently about writing when the, you know, wanting to be a nun thing was over because I had met the boys. But I thought I had a calling to do something, and I couldn't find it. But once I discovered alcohol, that spiritual quest I was on, the spirits of alcohol filled it up. And I felt great. I loved it. And it's not, you know, it's not every day I could get it, but I learned to water down my dad's booze. He had a business, and he had a lot of booze, so I watered it down. I learned how to steal from you and then invite you to my party. I learned how to manipulate and get what I needed. The town drunk would come and borrow a bottle from my dad and say, "Tell Frank I borrowed a bottle," and I would tell my dad he came for two, and I would get a bottle. So I was really good at getting my alcohol. And you know, it was the 60s. It wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. Nothing was wasted. I don't need the lid. Still a gulper. My husband looks at me and goes, "God, she's still a gulper." But life just really got fun, and I was an artist and a musician, and I went off to college, and I was going to marry this guy who I thought was really great to be around, and then I caught him being tutored, and it wasn't, you know, out of the books, and he broke my heart, and I didn't know quite how sensitive I was, and after that, I just didn't want to feel that kind of pain anymore, and I drank at the pain, and I used alcohol medicinally when I had pain. It worked for me. And I started to run with the people that seemed to be having more fun than going to college and, you know, taking these classes that I had to take. And I started to hang out exclusively at Joe's Place, the airliner, and out at the lake where we were doing some other stuff. And I was in this sorority, and I would go out to this lake in my pearls and black dress, and, you know, everybody would be in their bell-bottoms and their, you know, subversive, you know, army jackets, and I was friends with the SDS guys and the Black Panthers, and I'd be out there having a party, and I'd come in my black cocktail dress and pearls, and they didn't care because I was one of them, you know. But pretty soon the black cocktail dress and pearls went because my drinking kind of started to make an appearance, and people would say, you know, "You really need to get your life together here," and my response now was, "I don't need you. I'm having a good time. What do I need you for? You're boring." And pretty soon I would wake up and be very, very, very despondent because I knew something was going wrong. And I tried to kill myself. I cut my wrists. And my father and the priest came down to try to console me and see if they could help me at college. And the priest and I sat that night at this restaurant and just knocked them back. We got so drunk on whiskey sours. And my father was aghast. He just couldn't believe it. And I took him to the student union where there was a sit-in going on. And me and Father Kunsch were sitting there at the sit-in. And my father was standing like, you know, 50 feet away just going, "I can't believe this. This is the quiet little family priest. Or what has my daughter done to him?" But I could always find someone to have a good time with. It didn't matter who. But I never gave up my heart again. That was one thing I started to wall off. And my dad tried to help me. I mean, I would come home in the middle of the night and try to talk to him. "You want me to share with you, so I'm changing my name to Share, S-H-A-R-E, because I share and share alike, Dad," you know, just to needle him a little bit. And he didn't like that. You know, he didn't like he didn't want to know too much. And when my dad would ask, I would let him know everything because he had the big shoulders and he was the guy that could help me. and sent me to the doctor for Valium therapy, and I went back to church for a while until it was just like hypocrisy. I was looking for everything wrong everywhere. And then I would back my dad off with my anger and my pain and shut him off again. And I don't know how many times my dad tried to help, and I would do that to him. And pretty soon my dad and I don't sit down at the same breakfast table. Pretty soon my dad and I don't walk down the hallway at the same time because we might accidentally brush shoulders and then we might have to look at each other. And then I would see that disappointment and pain in his eyes, and he would see the defiance in my eyes, or maybe the sadness in my eyes. So my dad just stopped trying to help because he didn't know what to do. And after I did a lot of chapter three. I did a lot of moving. I did a lot of, I ended up in New York. And somewhere along the line of that next year after I left college, and I didn't graduate, I left college because I had a big fight with my father and he didn't want to pay anymore. So I'll show them. I'll go live in New York City. And I started to have anxiety attacks. I didn't know what they were. I started to have to drink martini lunches to keep it going. I didn't want to miss anything because I'm looking for truth really hard now. And so I would keep taking something to keep me up so that I wouldn't miss truth in case it happened at 4 in the morning. And then I would have to, smoke something to bring me down so I could make it to that ad agency so I could have my martini lunch again. And it was this crazy cycle. And it was the summer of the orange sunshine, and I was finding truth a lot, but it was melting before I could write it down. And it was a crazy summer, but I kept pushing myself. And I would do things like walk Central Park at 2 in the morning. And I would bring people home because you play the flute. That's great. Come on. Let's go do the tarot cards and, read the bumps on my head, because I had that done every Friday by a phrenologist just to see where I was at in life. I had a big fight with a priest at the Catholic Church. I had him so mad he came out of the confessional at me so I could show everybody, look at him. Look what he preaches, look what he does. And I was angry. I had no idea I was so angry. And that anger covered up the fear. We're driven by 100 forms of fear, I'll tell you. There was so much fear in my life, but the alcohol would quell it. And pretty soon I couldn't paint pictures anymore. Pretty soon I didn't sit down at the piano anymore. I couldn't remember anything. Pretty soon I'm going to sell that accordion. I mean, it's not cool. It wasn't cool then. It's not cool now, still playing the accordion. But, my dad being Czech, I wanted his eyes. So I learned to play that accordion so I could play in the Boddicker accordion band, and he would, watch me play and watch me solo. And hangover with the bellows shake is really hard, I must tell you, playing the accordion. But I risked it because I wanted my dad's eye. And but pretty soon all those things were gone. And I don't know, where the bartender would have even told me that, if you act like this, that's going to be the last of your dignity. And I'd say, who cares about dignity? And try saying that when you're drunk, dignity. Give me my booze. I don't know if the bartender would have been so clear to say, if you act like this, there goes your talents. Your God-given talents. They're going to run out your sleeve if you keep down this road called alcoholism. Would I have stopped? I don't think so. It was still working for me. And I stuck my thumb out a lot, and I went back to art school, and I couldn't paint. And I ended up in Colorado, and I ended up coming to California with Bob Dylan out of Aspen, Colorado. And I mean, I didn't ask him for his license. I really think it was Bob. Nobody, looked like him, sang like him. Summer he was missing. But I ended up at a commune, and he went his way, and I went mine. And they asked me to leave because I drank their bong wine. They were a little upset with me. And I'm sick, and I don't know alcoholism, and my pancreas is acting up, and my gallbladder's not working, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And I go back to my mom and dad's at 21, and it's over. It's over. My mother said, you can stay here, but please stay out of your dad's way. You break his heart. And please don't take any drugs in this house. So I drank in the taverns in Mount Vernon, Iowa, every single night, judging you in there. Billy Lang, look at him. I knew he'd be in here every night from high school. Now I'm in there judging him. And I ended up taking another geographic because my my dad and I couldn't even speak. We couldn't even speak. And I sat with the kids at my grandmother's house that Thanksgiving at the card tables because they didn't put me at the big table. I guess they thought I'd throw the turkey or maybe have a cathartic sob on the turkey or start some sort of victim list again. They just didn't know, you know, and what is she wearing and how come she smells funny. And nobody knew alcoholism. And I knew that I just don't belong to this family. And I just got to keep going. I just got to keep going. And that's what I did. And I took a lot of geographics and tried an organic farm for a while. And it was cold. And they drank organic wine, but they sipped it. Oh, it made me crazy. And we smoked this organic stuff from morning to night, morning to night. And we'd go buzzsaw wood and split wood. And I'd be so loaded. You know, and there goes the axe down on the chopping block. Oh, good, missed my toe, you know. And we made maple syrup and tapped maple trees for Christmas presents that year. And, you know, you go out there with these buckets and they're empty. And then you go collect the sap and you come back and you have these buckets of sap. It takes, like, I think, 50 gallons to make one good maple syrup gallon, 50 gallons of sap. And I'd be stuck, I'd fall through the crust of the snow and I'd have these heavy buckets and I'd be stuck out there in northern Wisconsin in the cold with buckets of sap. And I thought, oh my God, I don't like these people and they don't like me. And so I would get drunk and they would look at me like, can't you, what's wrong with you? Why do you act like that? You know, I'd kick the banjo and, you know, break the Pete Seeger records and snarl at all of them because they were just all too organic. And I would drink my cheap wine, and eventually they went off to do primal therapy. I got drunk and screamed at the sheep. It was just my cathartic. It was good for me. But they left me with a half acre of crop, which was beautiful stuff, and so that's what I tended to. And my friend Clarence the farmer was my buddy, and he would bring the wild turkey or something, and I'd hear that tractor around in the lane. I'm alone now. It's me, the dog, the horse, the cat, and my crop and my cheap wine that I could afford because I painted mailboxes. That's what I did for a living, and tend to my crop all summer long. So I hear the tractor coming, and I think, God, good, you know, some hard stuff is coming. And Clarence would be coming around the corner in his tractor. And the reason it was on a tractor, he had too many DWIs, so they revoked his license. And I was just back at a class reunion, and this guy that knew Clarence said, do you know he used to strap his wife in a chair on the tractor to take her to the chiropractor? I was like, now that's alcoholic innovation, you know. She may not need the chiropractor, but once she got there in the chair in the back of the tractor, she sure needed one. And I joined the carnival one night because the dope deal went bad, and it was there, and, you know, and I was starting to make kind of bad decisions. And so I ended up working my way south, calling my mother from somewhere down south and saying, well, I'm not in Wisconsin anymore. I'm with Matt Armstrong Shows, Mom. You should see I'm running the shooting gallery. And she started to cry. I was like, Mom, you're my cheerleader. You know, it's not hurting anybody but me. Leave me alone. And that is, like, on the scale of 1 to 10, a 10, I am not hurting anyone but me. Stand back and watch. Leave me alone. We heard a lot of people out there, but the delusion that I lived under was that I was independent. I don't need anyone. I've got that book, Be Here Now, by Baba Ram Dass in my backpack. My thumb is out. My dog is at my heels. I'm with the show. I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. And it was craziness. And I'm drinking tequila. And there were a lot of fights and a lot of moving in the middle of the night and just insanity. And I met a guy I was going to be with for 2 years. We hated each other after a week. But we got busted for drugs together and thrown in a southern jail. And the carnival, bye-bye, left town. Nobody came by to bail me out. And after being in there about a week, they handcuffed me and threw me in the car and took me to this office and threw me in this office door, and there was my dad. I didn't want to see my dad, and my dad didn't want to see me. And I was insane and disheveled, and I had gone through DTs in jail. And he hired this lawyer and tried to help get me out because that's what my dad does. And when I was 20 years sober, my sponsor allowed me to go talk to my dad about that day because I don't remember that day. I am so glad that my sponsors, every time I have a sponsor and I'm working on amends, they guide me. Because I used to think the amends were about me walking down the sunny side of the street. they are not about me. My amends are not about me at all. And so I didn't get to go home and scratch at all the wounds and, you know, I'm in AA now, it's going to be great, and do you remember this, and do you remember that? And I was guided through my amends with my family, thank goodness. So when I was 20, I was allowed to go home and ask my dad about that day, the day of in front of the lawyer in Bogalusa, Louisiana, handcuffed and a mess, and because I don't remember it. And I said, Dad, do you remember that day? Well, that's, you know, a leading question. Of course, he got on an airplane, had to change planes, had to rent a car, had to find where his daughter was, had to bring his checkbook, had to hire a bail bondsman, had to hire an attorney. Of course he remembered. So he just kind of laughed. He said, yeah, I remember. And we talked about that day because I don't remember it. I remember sitting next to him, shoulder to shoulder, and the lawyer was behind the desk. And I remember trying to look at him out of the corner of my eye. I didn't want to look at him. And my dad was kind of looking at me out of the corner of his eye, too. And there was no more hugs like, come home, we know we can help you, or we don't know what's wrong with you, but we'll get some help, or there was no more of that. My dad was just being responsible. And he said that all I said during that whole visit was that it wasn't my fault, and I'm not guilty. It didn't matter what they found in the motel room. It's not my fault, and I'm not guilty. And I was living under that delusion about everything in my life. Whatever went wrong, it wasn't my fault. You want to hear my victim list? Let's put Ray Price on for the good times. Let's start drinking Tanqueray. I'll start crying on your boots, and we will really get to the list, you know, of being a victim. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous like that, a victim and broken. But with my list, I had my list, and it literally took me until I was 7 years sober to clean out myself of self so that the light of a higher power could enter my heart. And it says in the book, the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty. I love those words. That our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. Not okay, miraculous. I love that. I love the way that makes me feel. I love the way it motivates me to give it back. I love the way it wants me to get, my soul wants to get closer to God every single day. I love that. And I was so selfish and sad and sorry. And that's what I drug in here. And I had a lot of moving to do after that, but let's just say I ended up in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And I was a dancer, and the guy I was with for those 2 years was a barker. And then I'd start attending bar, and he started working tugboats. And he liked to shoot this stuff called heroin, which I didn't ever understand. Anybody face down going, let's party. You know, I'm up and moving, and let's go to Florida in the middle of the night, and let's move to St. Louis, or, you know, I'm a tequila up and going girl. And we hated one another. He had a pet skunk named Crank. It didn't like my dog. My dog didn't like the skunk. The skunk didn't like me. We got a snake. We thought maybe that would just kind of calm everybody down. And for 2 years we were together, and we were knife fights and black eye relationship in craziness. And I thought that was love, I guess. I had gotten so warped and twisted and dark about that. I mean, my dad would kiss my mother after every meal and tell her what a good cook she was. There was love in our house. There wasn't hand on hand in our house growing up. And now it's absolutely normal for me to live like that. But I must tell you, the beautiful thing about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, working the steps, trying to give it away, having those come on midnight days where you just hang in. It's come on midnight. It's a spiritual day if I make it to midnight. Hanging in through that and trying to be teachable and stay teachable and be sponsored and be part of the force for good in the world. All of that has brought the innocence back in my life in a way which I had no idea could ever, ever come back. And what a beautiful gift that was to have happened for me. Now, when I see that happen to some of the women I sponsor as they get through a certain spot in their lives or, second time through the steps that they've got to work again, or the amends, the big amends they just finished, you can see that brightness just kick it up. And, you know, we all blush at dirty jokes now, you know, things like that. And I love seeing that happen because it just renews me that this is an absolute miraculous program that saves lives. And my parents came to visit, found me living with Skunk Man, new black eye that morning. Skunk running around, droppings everywhere, filth, craziness. I look at the door, there's my mother. I have my platinum blonde wig on and my outfit with the zippers and my platform shoes and fishnet stockings. And I was dancing on Bourbon Street, and I would go out and do pose my number, and my fishnets would get stuck in the staples from the palm tree, which was stapled to the wall, you know. So I would, like, be so drunk I'd have to lean on the palm tree, and then my fishnet would get stuck in the staples, and the spot's on, and it's my number. It's like, oh, God, trying to wiggle away from the palm tree. And I've been drinking Cavassier all night with the bartender, and it's like, ah, screw it, and I just rip it out, you know, and then your leg goes through the side, and then you're dancing on that baby grand. It's not even big enough, really, and those platform shoes make me so unbalanced. I don't know why they fired me. I would just fall off a lot. I asked for a raise, and they fired me. So I became a bartender, and there's my mom and dad that morning, and my dad doesn't come in, and my mom came in, and I remember a little bit, tears in her eyes. I don't remember my younger sister and younger brother being there until I found out about 7 years ago they were on that trip too. And that Skunk Man had taken my sister out. They were going to go get some sandwiches, and he took her to a girly show. And that my little brother, in fact, it was just, he just said it, he just, he was small and he didn't, he had to put his hands in his pockets, and he didn't know what to do because he loved me, and that man was hurting his sister that he loved, that jerk. And my brother was small and couldn't do anything about it. So I'm a blackout drinker. So if for the rest of my life I get to try to rub out the record, if for the rest of my life I get to try to be part of the force for good. And as Chuck C., when I would hear him talk, he always said, it rains on the just and the unjust, and it's not my job to judge. I get that. I just have to be awake. I have to be of maximum service. I have to be awake to see who needs what done. And if I can be a kind person and do it and help them, that's my job. That's page 77. It says our purpose right there is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And if I swear to God, I took hundreds of hits to just to find something so beautiful and wonderful that once I died to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was right there in black and white for me. I have a purpose. I hope you find your purpose. I hope you find it in the book. I hope you take it into the world. Whatever it is that you're here to give, it's your special gift. And a lot of people leave the gift on the seat and walk out, and we never see them again. And we are the lucky ones. In 1975... the thing with Skunk Man was all over, thank goodness. I was really running alone. I was really sick. I had had some surgery. The doctor had said before, he said, you know, you look like an old lady inside. Do you abuse drugs or alcohol? And that was my organic phase. I told him I was organic. So maybe somebody was trying to spot it way back when. Something was wrong with me. And I was over 170 pounds. I didn't really eat, but I was bloated and toxic, and I wore a red dashiki and a Panama hat, and I became unemployable, and I got asked to leave in Maryland in a snowstorm with the Volkswagen van. They came and found me in New York because my friend had gotten shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day, and I was in a blackout, and I didn't know if I had anything to do with it, and I ended up in New York, and they came and found me, and they had just gotten some money from a publishing house, and I was the artist in the bar. I sat by a lot of you astronauts, you know, and a lot of you first ladies and a lot of you surgeons, but whatever you wanted to be in the bar, we could be. I love the bars. And so I was the artist. So they came and found me, and they got this money, and Andy Black, who's dead from alcoholism, and Sam God, who I can't find, kicked me out in Maryland because I was too depressing for them. The way you drink, you get so depressing. We just can't stand to be around you. And they sat me on my suitcase in a snowstorm in Maryland. We were coming to California. And I just sat there in the snowstorm on my suitcase thinking, okay, now what? And they came back and got me and felt bad. And I blamed it on the cheap vodka they bought, if we should buy the good stuff, not that thrifty stuff. And I ended up in California where I was unemployable. I couldn't tend bar anymore. I couldn't remember where the drinks went. I couldn't be a cocktail waitress. I couldn't remember where the drinks went. And I ended up back in New Orleans, and nobody wanted to let me tend bar anymore. And I was just on the run and scared. I was so scared. I had no idea I was so scared. I didn't know I took me with me all the time. It's like, oh, God, there I am again. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a speaker named Norm Alpe used to talk a lot. He was great. He lit up the room. And Norm said, you want to know why the grass is greener, newcomer? I was like, oh, God, truth. I've been waiting for truth. I stood up really straight and tall, and he says, because the other guy took care of his lawn. Oh, and he'd laugh. And I think that's it. I always wanted your lawn. You took care of it. I didn't take care of mine. And then he said, because good old-timers, they don't give you truth without hope, you know. They give you truth, it hurts a little, then they give you hope. And he said, you know what? If you're new, we know what you're made of. Oh, my God, some more truth. And I sat up really straight and tall. He said, fertilizer. I was like, okay, Norm says I made a fertilizer. Somehow it made sense. And he said, we're going to dig it under, and we're going to make a great lawn. Ah, ha, ha, hang in there, newcomer. It was like, okay, it all made sense to me. And that's what I drug in here. It was my bag of fertilizer and my barren lawn and an ember of life. I was an ember of life. And instead of cupping it and making it go out, you put some kindling on it. You put some kindling on my ember. July 27, 1975, I went to Palm Springs on the back of a Harley because I like tequila and Harleys and instant gratification. This long-term comfort stuff I had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I just thought they were going to party with me, and they left me at the bar, and they said they just needed a little extra weight, so that was why I got to come along. I got in a situation that night in a blackout where I don't remember much. I had a concussion, my jaw broken in three places, and my nose broken, and I still have scars on my elbows and my knees from them dragging me around on the cement, and I was pretty beaten up. But when they tossed me outside of the car, outside of town, it was as hot like here. It was Palm Springs in July. And I'm face down in the sand, and I kind of come to for a little bit when I hear the car door slam. And I hear a voice that says, get up, I want to live. The great fact deep down within. There was enough of me gone that I heard a piece of truth deep within me. It said, get up, I want to live. And I was a victim of violent crime. I was in a hospital. They wired my jaw shut. They, you know, pushed me around, and I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky my scars don't show. Very lucky. I still see x-rays sometimes if they have to x-ray my neck, and I look at all the wires in my face, and I think, oh, yeah, that's right, they're still there. But that's what it took for me to come to you. I'm laying in a hospital, and a guy from Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood said he knew I had no place to go. After 2 weeks, he came and picked me up, and I was drinking red wine through the wires in the mouth where the tooth had been kicked out, and that he would go off to work and buy me cheap wine in the morning. And on August 20th, he said, you got to leave, you're depressing me. And I called my mom. And my mom had gotten a panicked phone call from somebody who had heard what had happened to me. And they called her in Iowa and told her that I was in a hospital, but they didn't tell her what city in California. So for two nights, my mother in Iowa and my sister in New York called every hospital in California until they found me and found out I was going to be okay. So my mother didn't sleep for those two nights. I know she didn't, because my mother worries about me. She would only know half of the stuff that happened. I'm a mom today, and I don't know if I could do that. When I called and asked her for help, she said, Sharon, go to the Salvation Army. I can't help you anymore. And Norm used to talk about seconds and inches, that we are the lucky ones by seconds and inches to be here. Because $20 in an envelope, I would have held on for that. Just $20. and you'd have another speaker. So we are the lucky ones, just by the hair of our chinny chin chin chin, that we get to be here and hear the music of Chapter 5 read, where there's hope for us. And I ended up calling a girl from Barney's that I knew, because her phone number's there, and I didn't relate, but she was an In-N-Out member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she knew who to tell me to call next because she was drinking that day. And I called somebody I don't know I'm calling a member of AA. Suzanne on the other end of the phone knew she had a live one because I had talked like this, because I really couldn't talk. For the first 3 months in AA, I was wired shut. It was a blessing. I had to learn to listen. So Suzanne, don't drink anything, don't smoke anything. I thought, how does she know? I have both in my hands. And two girls came and got me. I didn't want to go with them, but I was tired. And they just picked me up and put me in the back of a Volkswagen where I couldn't get out. And we ended up at an Echo Park meeting in Los Angeles, where a man wouldn't leave me alone until I gave him a quarter for a book. He kept talking about payment terms. And I'm starting to have a few hallucinations now. I really don't know what's going on, but I gave him a quarter, and he was so happy. And he came back with this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, oh, I don't talk. I just kind of... And he wrote in that book, he wrote my sobriety date, and he wrote where I was, and it's all in pencil. And I still have that book, all in pencil. It's still written there in pencil. Because I got to live a day at a time. I got to live a moment at a time. I don't get to live 32 years at a crack. I've been living life and growing and changing and laughing and crying and looking at myself and giving it up. And, you know, a lot of times my surrender is just quit fighting. Just quit fighting. I don't know how to let go. Sometimes you got to just one finger at a time scrape it out of my hand, but I do know how to quit fighting. I do know that. My second sponsor, I remember she said, you know, you remind me of the girl with a turd. I was like, what? Thank you, you know. I was about 5 years sober, and she said, you remember that girl Sandra who used to be around here, and she was kind of wacky, and she walked around with something in her pocket all the time, and then she'd look at it at the meeting and not let anybody see and put it back in her pocket. You remind me of her. It's like, you know, we finally saw it one day, and it was old dried up turd. You remind me of the girl with the turd. It was like, well, thank you. Is this a compliment or not? Or she said, you know, you just hang on to these things. And it's like, and I remember looking at her with every bit of my 5 year rights back and go, I know, but it's my turd and it belongs to me. You know, it's like, she went, oh God, we got some work to do. And that was my second sponsor at 5 years. But, you know, I do know how to quit fighting, and that helps so much. Letting go and working the steps and getting to the point of being able to see my defects of character, and then are they useful, are they not useful, and I'm useful to somebody else, and they stay in my life, and it's like, oh God, you know, please, you know, humbly ask him. And I've had one big one removed, and the rest must be useful, as that prayer says. Somehow, some way, they're helping somebody else, so they're mine. And they rear their head from time to time, and all I can tell you is that I've learned how to eat crow when it's warm. It tastes better if you're eating crow when it's warm. And I don't trip over my feet a lot anymore, but when I do, it's real obvious to me, and I live in here, and I'm happy living in here today. So I like to have that connection with my higher power. I like to have that connection with the energy and the love that's in the world, not just in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I need God with skin on. I got to come sit in a meeting and rub shoulders with you. I got to hear Chapter 5. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, I know. Oh, boy, am I sick. Oh, boy, am I well. You know, I just need to be with you. You're my people. This is the mothership. And the guy at my very first meeting said he always waited for the mothership to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. Oh, my God, he knows how I feel, a spaceship guy. And that was all I remember my first meeting. And they let me sit in the back of that car until the liquor store lights turned off. I was living above a liquor store. I was detoxing, and I hadn't bathed, and I wasn't good to be around when it came to, you know, your olfactory senses. But people could love me anyway, and that's the activist I'm with, because I'm still in that group today. They didn't say, oh, there, honey, we'll see you next week, hang in there, because I had nowhere to go. I had a big book now. I had my paper bag of mismatched goods. I had my Be Here Now in my backpack, and my mother sent me a blender so I could eat. And I had a borrowed sleeping bag, and I slept on different floors of women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had no idea they were giving me a chance, and they were. And I got a sponsor because they wouldn't leave me alone until I got one, and she moved me to her couch. So it's like, get a sponsor, your life gets better. She taught me how to pray. She wrote down little tiny prayers for me. She said, before you go to bed on my couch, you have to say this prayer at night. And it was like, oh, I can't remember it, you know. It's like, she knew, and she wrote it down for me. And I would, like, sneak out at 2 in the morning out of that sleeping bag and say a quick prayer and then sneak back in that sleeping bag because I didn't want God to know where I was. I didn't want God to know where I was, you know. Just let me be here for a little while, and maybe then, you know, I'll be in your favor. And that's the kind of God I left behind, because the God I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is love. And I see it every time I see the light go on in somebody's eyes. That I came in here dead, dead-eyed and ember. And about 3 months of sobriety, somebody snapped a picture, and there's still nobody home yet. It took a while. I had to do some of these steps, you know. The sponsor had me do a third step with her on our knees. I was embarrassed, very embarrassed, that we were on our knees in her living room. And after we got up and she hugged me and she wouldn't stop hugging me, she was so excited and turned on. She was so happy. Janet was so happy. She wouldn't stop hugging me, and I wanted to hit her because I know you just don't touch me like this. And so finally, after she didn't stop hugging me, she transferred something to me, and I started to feel all warm and wonderful. And I thought, oh, God, I must be gay. I'm in love with my sponsor, you know. That is how the broken computer of emotions, you know. Maybe you catch a little spark with the wire. It took a long time. Am I angry? Am I hungry? Oh, I didn't eat today. Let's go eat. I mean, it took a long time for me to come back to life. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous would give me encouragement. A man named Chuck Nesbitt would see me and he'd go, boy, you look tired, kid. You better stay with us a while. I thought, how does he know I'm so tired? You know? And he would look at me writing down on my list that somebody gave me $5. And on that list was how many rides I had gotten from people and people that had given me packs of cigarettes or people that had given me money or clothes. And he looked at that list one day and he said, put that list away, Sharon. We don't want it anymore. We don't want it. We don't want to see it. Someday. And what was so beautiful about this was that he entrusted with me and in me the principles of what we do for each other, which is give it away freely, for fun and for free. He said, someday you're going to have a car, a license, insurance, all in the same name. I thought, how does he know that? And you'll be able to give rides to newcomers. Someday you're going to have a couch somebody can sleep on. Someday you're going to have a whole bunch of clothes and you're going to know that new girl's starting a job and you'll have them all folded up nice in the car and you'll bring them to her after the meeting. That's the way we want to be paid back, pass it on. And he gave me some dignity that night. And that's the way the people treated me in Alcoholics Anonymous, like I mattered. Because I certainly didn't matter to myself. I've been trying to kill me for a long time. And that's the way that I was treated. Now, I learned from some of the best with commitments, too. This lady, June Ann, who was always complaining about her sponsor, Clancy, and I would, like, you know, sit with her at the coffee shop, and we'd drive around until she'd be out of gas, because I'm not sleeping, you know, I'm not working, I'm wired up, and she'd whine and whine and whine, and I'd just sit there because I couldn't talk. But, you know, we'd just drive and drive, and she was real good to me. She was real good to me, and June Ann had a commitment. I had got the cup washing commitment. They let me get my hands wet. And June Ann was cookie girl. So we would go to this meeting together, and she'd drop me off and then go get cookies and come back. And I'd help her put them on the trays. And one night she didn't come back. And I'll tell you, if you want a powerful commitment where you're going to be missed, it's cookie girl, you know. Everybody's like, you know, where's my Nutter Butters? Where's my Oreos? And then finally it's, where's June Ann, you know? And the meeting's about ready to start, and the LAPD black and white pulls up to the curb and his long steps up to this church where he had our meeting, and this cop is walking up, and the secretary goes down to talk to the cop to find out what's going on. And so we hear this talk, and they're walking up, and all of a sudden we kind of, you know, a little circle forms around, and they're talking about June Ann. Well, June Ann. And the cop's saying, yeah, I guess she bought some cookies and then she went back in the store and stole these candy bars and she got caught and then I got to take her in and she's in the car, but here she made me promise to bring these cookies to the meeting. I was like, those are my teachers, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, and she didn't make it. Junanne didn't make it. I found her in, living in Atlanta, and I got to see her and bring her pictures of my son. And my Christmas card came back stamped deceased that year. But she's one of my heroes. She's one of the shoulders of the giants I get to sit on in Alcoholics Anonymous. So they give me a better life. And so I get to give a better life to somebody else. And she had every right to stay here like me, but she picked up a drink. That's the only difference. Only difference. I got married. After I went home and I made some amends. And my dad and I, it was very stilted, but it was a start. And I started to come alive after that inventory and starting to make my amends. And I started working in the working world, and things were changing. And I Boy Meets Girl in AA campus, and my dad came out and walked me down the aisle. I was 2.5 years sober, and my father, I have a picture of how proud he was that day. He went to a meeting, he met all of you, he bought a book, he loved it. He said, at the end of my wedding day, somebody snapped a picture and gave it to me, and I just found it about 5 years ago. Because I was having one of those Peggy Lee moments at the end of my wedding day. My chin was on my hands, and I was looking around the room, and I was thinking, is that all there is? The Peggy Lee moment at my wedding. And my dad was across from me, and we were eyeball to eyeball. Somebody snapped a picture. And I remember he came over and sat down, and he looked at me, and he says, Sharon, look at your life. You've got it made. If you think of doing what you were doing before, think twice. And it was, I remember that moment. My dad approved of you. My dad was saying, you're doing all right, kid. And I didn't look at him and go, well, it's about time you noticed. I didn't look at him and go, okay, the angels are going to sing now. I just said, you're right, Dad. And the neat thing about that is my dad got to see his daughter get sober and happier and more in the world. And my little boy, they came out when he was baptized. When I was 10 years sober, I went through a messy divorce because he wanted the newcomer in the room, and it was awful. My sponsor smoked pot, and I ended up with Clancy as my sponsor because I needed someone louder in my head. And I was going to throw hot coffee on him one night. Jill and Al were having a good time over in the corner of the room, and I was on my way with my 2 hot cups of black coffee, my ex and his new pregnant and married in that order wife, newcomer. Chubbier than me, not as cute as me, not as sincere. And my sponsor happened to be there that night. He took the coffee out of my hands and he said, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace. And if he would have stopped there, I'd say, I don't give a rat's about dignity or grace. I'm going to take his car and drive it to the ocean on low tide and leave it there. But he added the words louder than my head so you can be an example to others. Didn't want to hear that. Didn't want to hear his truth, which was my truth. But I walked through it with dignity and grace. I didn't want to. It was crazy that year. Janine was along for a lot of it. She was babysitting my son. We went to AA everywhere. Get in the car. Where are we going? Sacramento. I got to pee. Too bad. We're going. You know, it's just, I was driven. I was driven. When I was about 5 years sober, I started to pay my dad back the money I owed him because my second sponsor asked me to. And I sent my dad a check every month, and he had read the big book and had already run the calculator tape, so he was ready for me to call. And my sponsor said, put a note with the check so your dad gets to know your life. And I sent my dad that check and that note because I'm the only example of Bill and Bob he might ever see, she told me. Don't be late with that check and tell him about your life. And it was going on 5 years, right about the time my life fell apart. And my dad called me between Christmas and New Year's, and he said, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, honey. I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes. And my dad and I got to have a sense of innocence about our relationship that I never thought was possible. But that was good sponsorship. That was good sponsorship. So at 10 and a half, when my life fell apart and my car died and I called him, And we laughed about the car throwing a rod in my hands and how it felt, and AA car with 180,000 miles on it, and my son, and having night tremors, and I wasn't working yet. And 2 days later, they called me. My dad said, the banker had an extra car. It has 7,000 miles on it. We're driving it out. And my mom and dad got in that car from Iowa and drove it out to me for fun and for free because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought those amends were for me. But they were so my dad could be my dad and my mom could be my mom when their daughter was going through something tough. Because I'm a mom and that's all you want. You just want to help them out. And the record was clean so my father could say, here's a car. I took two cars from him in my using drinking days. But the record was clean because of my financial amends that he was able to say, I'm driving you out a car. That spiritual principle is something that is so powerful. It changes everything in your life. I work around a lot of men. I've been 20 years in the legal profession. And there's no little girl guilt going on in there. I am toe-to-toe, you know, 5'7 or whatever in that room with them. And I respect myself and I can respect them and we're on an equal basis. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so many freedoms. That's just two or three or four of them. I can go anywhere. I can go back to New Orleans. I sponsor a girl from there now. We drank together and died together. She's 24 years sober. It's an amazing thing. We drank together and we died together, and I get to be her sponsor today. And I just want to let you know that the ex-husband and the second wife split up, and how they come is how they go sometimes. She told me she knew she could do it because she had watched me walk through it with dignity and grace. So it's not my job to figure out who gets it. I'm just supposed to do it. I got married here a year ago. We went to the Bellagio, and Casey and I were together. Well, we've been together 20 years, married one, living together two. So I worked a little slow in there after all that stuff happened. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the coffee pot's on, and we have rescue animals. I've made my amends to the animal kingdom, and we sponsor a lot of people, and we're busy and happy, and my son is not an alcoholic and has found his gift for life. And, you know, I just sit there in the morning when I have my morning meditation, and I just thank God because I give it right back to God and ask him what I can do to shine today. I think all you really need to do to be a spiritual person and live a spiritual life is to brighten the corner where you live. It's really very simple. There's no big, you know, one behind the one behind the one. It's just to brighten the corner where you live. And I get to do that wherever I go. What a privilege. And a very much a privilege being with you tonight. Thanks for having me.